Hello, everybody. It's Steve Baker, your friendly neighborhood pragmatic constitutionalist. It's Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving, and as you can see from the tree beside me, if you can see through the glare of the bright, sunshiny day here in Washington, D.C., I'm at my Airbnb, and all the leaves are gone. When I first started podcasting from here, reporting on the Oath Keepers trial, that tree was full and green. They began to turn with the autumn colors. Then those leaves went brown, and now that tree is completely bare. That's how long I've been here covering the Oath Keepers trial, from day one until the closing arguments. And now, as of yesterday morning, the fate of these five defendants are in the hands of the jury. They actually only had, the jury, only one full day of deliberations yesterday before the holiday break. They will resume deliberations on Monday morning. Being that this is a multi-defendant trial with so many different charges against each individual, including the incredibly complex conspiracy charges, I was pretty sure there was no way that the jury would come back with a verdict on day one of deliberations, regardless of their own personal and political predispositions. I think even they believed that they needed to give each defendant's unique case, their own charges, and the evidence for and against each a decent once-over before coming back with a verdict. You know, some combination of guilty, not guilty, or even being hung up on a few charges. We don't know. At the very least, they needed to put on a show. A quick verdict in such a complex case would scream that the fix was in. Still, so cocksure was Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeff Nessler that he confidently told one of the defense attorneys while leaving the courtroom Monday afternoon that he fully expected a unanimous guilty verdict to have been presented yesterday. Well, that didn't happen. So after I take a couple of days myself to go spend time with my own kids for Thanksgiving, I'll be back in the courthouse on Monday, verdict watching, until these five defendants' fates are declared. I've got a lot to say about this trial, and much more will be said over time as I break down the various bits and pieces and try to draw more accurate conclusions from what I've seen over this time. But I'm going to share with you some of my most recent thoughts and observations, especially at what took place in the last couple of days of the trial, focusing mainly on the closing arguments that were made. But before I do that, let me get my one commercial announcement out of the way first. They say that you have not because you ask not. So here's the need. I simply can't do this, what I'm doing now, without your support. Like the mainstream media journalists that I've shared the media room over the last 8 weeks, I'm not drawing a paycheck from one of those media giants. The expenses of doing this are 100% on me. And, it's made possible only by the generosity of those who believe in what I'm doing. Being in D.C. these many weeks, honestly, has taken a tremendous toll on me financially. Not just the obscene expense of being here, but then there's also that which is called the lost opportunity cost of not paying any attention to my other career in the music business while doing what I'm doing now. It's not an easy feat to reinvent oneself at any age, but at my age, and especially after the COVID lockdowns and January 6th and the severe economic downturn that we're going through, fate seems to have forced me into this new phase of life, focusing on journalism and investigative journalism as opposed to my music career. Now, I'm not complaining. I believe that this is what I'm supposed to be doing, but that transition has not yet been paid for. I have nothing to sell you. I can only do this. Whether it's covering the Oath Keepers trial, chasing down a child trafficking case in Texas, or revealing the lies of the COVID tyranny, or whatever else is next in line for me, I can only do this with your support. Here's the easiest three ways to help. Please go and follow and subscribe to our Locals community for as little as $5 per month. It's actually free to subscribe there as a read-only member, but you can get full membership privileges, including the ability to post your own content in our community and to also receive supporter-exclusive content that I don't post anywhere else on any of our own or other social media platforms. Or you can get 2 free months with an annual subscription of only $50. And then finally, if you're simply one of those people that just don't like to subscribe to things or be obligated to another subscription of any kind, you can make a one-time donation there on our Locals page of any size. Just go to thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com. thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com, or you can go to your app store and download the Locals app, then search for my handle, which is @TPC4USA, @TPC4USA. Now, a little bit of insider info. Because of Apple and Google App Store rules related to setting up subscription services through their approved apps, it's actually easier if you set up your Locals subscription on your computer, and then you can access it from your app. But if you set up the subscription there first, either on your computer or on one of your device browsers, that's the best way to go. So even on your devices, phone, iPad, whatever, go to thepragmaticconstitutionalist.locals.com on the browser. That's the best way to go. One final note, despite the generosity of some, the expenses of this trial, me being here covering this trial in DC, hasn't come close to being covered. And I'm now being asked to actually cover another J6 related trial, and it's not as big as this one, but it's every bit as important. So I haven't made my decision yet. A lot of that will be determined upon cost, expenses, and income. But those, you know, $5 monthly subscriptions are important, so I'm not belittling those by any means. But I do need, if you can, I need a couple of people who could step forward that who have the capability to help offset the lion's share of these expenses with a single donation or more. So if you can come forward with that, please do so. It would be very much appreciated. I was actually blessed by one such contributor for the child trafficking case that I've been working in Houston, which I'll be going back to very soon. There's a lot left on the table down there that I need to get back to, and I hope that someone or a couple of someones will feel just as led to help with these current projects and these stories related to the January 6th defendants. These stories are making a difference. I'm hearing the feedback, and I'm blessed by that. Okay, thank you. Back to the report on the last days of this trial. I haven't done a video update on the trial for several days, frankly, because I was just simply overwhelmed with all that's been happening toward the end of last week. We fully expected the closing arguments would begin as early as last Wednesday afternoon until Jonathan Crisp, the attorney representing Jessica Watkins, pulled a shocking surprise by calling his client to the stand to testify on her own behalf. Now, Crisp had not shared this with anyone, not any of the other defense attorneys, not the government's attorneys, and also not with Judge Maida. Immediately upon calling Jessica Watkins to the stand, the media room gasped. I mean, they literally gasped aloud. Then Mr. Crisp informed the court, informed Judge Maida. He said, and I quote, "This may take a while. Do you want to break for lunch before we begin?" Well, Maida was shocked, and immediately he called a sidebar. It's one of those moments where he tells the attorneys to pick up the phones, and we get white noise down in the media room so we can't hear what they're saying. Really loud noise. And then when he returned from the sidebar, he instantly dismissed the jury for lunch. Then Judge Maida said in the open court, he said, "It would have been nice to know this when I talked to the jury earlier." Now, what he was referring to was the fact that he had gone over potential schedules for the rest of the week and then going into Thanksgiving week with the jury. Well, he was openly pissed. And as a matter of fact, after he said that, he just stood up and stormed out of the courtroom without the normal decorum and ceremony that they do when they exit the courtroom. His hopes for a verdict before Thanksgiving were pretty much shot to hell at that point. Now, another interesting aspect of this judge's feigned impartiality in this case is his long history directly related to Jessica Watkins, and this goes all the way back to her initial arrest. He's had her case since the very beginning. Back on February 26th of 2021, almost 2 years ago, Judge Amit Maida said this during one of her earliest detention hearings. He said, and I quote, "She was not a follower. She was higher up in the chain. She was a recruiter and did recruit others to participate in the events of January 6th. She is not just a foot soldier. She is someone planning, organizing larger groups of people." Of course, As we know from the evidence presented in this trial, Jessica Watkins was no leader in the Oath Keepers. She had just the year before attempted to establish her own militia. She called it the OSRM, or Ohio State Regular Militia, which never had more than even six members at any time. That she was someone, I quote again, someone planning, organizing larger groups of people, that was a lie then, and it has persisted as a lie during the government's case against her in this trial. Now, Watkins' testimony and cross-examinations did not end until the next day. Then the government called one final rebuttal witness on their behalf, FBI Special Agent Harris. Now, this was his third time on the stand in this trial, and this, of course, was to button up some of their arguments that they had made earlier. Then Judge Maeda began his long set of jury instructions to conclude Thursday's session. Then, on the first thing Friday morning, Assistant U.S. Attorney Catherine Ricozzi began the government's closing summation with a blatant distortion of facts, actually quoting Stuart Rhodes when he said at some point, sometime in some one of his texts or messages or dissertations that he makes to Oath Keepers and others, he actually said, and I quote, "We are not getting through this without a civil war. Prepare your mind, body, and spirit." Now, he wasn't talking about January 6th, by the way. It is what he said. He said the words, "We are not getting through this without a civil war. Prepare your mind, body, and spirit." And as I said, he said this somewhere, someplace, sometime, but not about January 6th. But Assistant U.S. Attorney Ricozzi then followed that quote by saying that Rhodes himself had called for civil war. Now, when you look at that quote, no, that's not what he said. He said to prepare. He did not call for civil war. Now, I'm not interested in defending Rhodes' more hyperbolic, often very conspiratorial language about either Trump calling for the Insurrection Act or what he personally believes about the direction of the country under what he called the Chi-Com puppet regime, in other words, the Biden administration. The fact is, from the very beginning, I've said this trial was about scary words uttered by Rhodes and some of the other of the four defendants. It has never been about their scary deeds. Those did not happen. They were not planned, as the government asserts, but they said a lot of harsh things before, during, and even after January 6th. Sometimes things they were saying was about what they were prepared to do should the circumstance arise and if needed. Sometimes they were willing to do certain things that they talked about that sounded like scary things if either Antifa launched a major offensive at one of the many events for which they were providing personal security details. And then also even on January 6th, they talked about things that they could have done afterwards as well, had certain circumstances presented themselves, like, for instance, Trump calling for or invoking the Insurrection Act, which he did not do. What the government was never able to do was to present evidence of actual planning or orders from Rhodes and the other defendants to commit the actual crimes for which they've been charged. Time and time again, under cross-examination, the many FBI special agents presenting testimony against the Oath Keepers were forced to admit that they had no messages, that they had no chats, no phone call transcripts, or written orders for the total of the 14 alleged co-conspirators to either storm the Capitol, to hunt down Congress members, or to stop the certification of the Electoral College vote. And most importantly, nothing that these five defendants did on that day accomplished any of those stated crimes. They never even made an effort to accomplish those alleged crimes. Only three of these defendants even entered the Capitol building, and that was for less than 20 minutes. They actually formed a circle in the rotunda and prayed, a prayer circle. Really dangerous activity there. They took up position between Officer Harry Dunn and some of the more aggressive protesters, keeping those protesters from forcing themselves against Officer Dunn and then the staircase that he was defending with an M4 rifle. They actually defused the situation. Then they left the building voluntarily. They didn't leave the building because they were forced out by any law enforcement officers at all. They just walked out. Only Jessica Watkins got caught up in a shoving scrum where protesters were trying to force their way down toward the Senate chamber. And this is an action for which she took full responsibility when she testified on the stand, and for which her own attorney, Jonathan Crisp, ultimately said that she should be found guilty for, but then, of course, found not guilty for the other charges presented. Neither Stuart Rhodes or Thomas Caldwell, the other really scary-mouthed guy in this trial, entered the Capitol building. Neither of those two. But during the government's closing argument, Assistant U.S. Attorney Ricozzi's hyperbolic exaggerations of her assertions were, quite frankly, every bit as egregious as anything or any of the inflammatory talk between some of those oath keepers. The difference is that they, the oath keepers, never actually carried or used any weapons on anyone at any time, any place, anywhere, and not on January 6th. But some of those defendants had SWAT teams raid their homes with red dots trained upon them from automatic weapons, and four of the five have now been held for many months at gunpoint in various detention centers, some for almost 2 years now. In fact, during Thomas Caldwell's testimony, we learned that the raid on he and his wife's Virginia farm occurred on this pre-dawn, early morning, January morning, winter cold day with bullhorns blaring, a threat of a battering ram to kick in their door if they didn't come out. And then the 69-year-old, 100% combat-disabled veteran was forced outside and onto the ground in his underwear on that cold January morning while other agents, 25 agents, had their red dots trained on his 60-something-year-old wife while she was wearing nothing but her little thin nightie in that cold air. Caldwell, as I said, never entered the Capitol building. He's never actually even been a member of the Oath Keepers, but he has the salty language of a 20-year military veteran. Caldwell was a naval intelligence commander. He also worked for the FBI after retiring from the Navy and has never been arrested or charged with a crime in his lifetime. But at his arraignment, the FBI actually lied to the judge, not only obscuring his service record and his own time with the FBI, but told the judge that he had an extensive criminal record. Now, obviously, those lies were revealed and countered in court, but the government was undeterred as they proceeded with their closing arguments, which were filled with extensive distortion of language, intentions of the defendants, distortions and lies about their actions leading up to and on the day of January 6th. And so when it was their turn, the defense teams did exactly what they should have done. They came out swinging for the fence in their closing arguments, literally calling the government's case a pack of lies, as well as mischaracterization of the facts, timelines presented, and the truth itself. Over and over again, each attorney, in defense of their individual clients, pointed out that every single time they cross-examined the many FBI agents who testified, that none of them were able to produce written or verbal evidence of any orders or commands for these defendants to either storm the Capitol, hunt Congress members, or stop the certification of the election. Now, interestingly, late in the trial, the government, realizing that this was happening and that maybe their story or their theory was breaking down in the face of this denial of evidence, what they did is they changed their narrative completely. They switched their theme from trying to assert an explicit ordered plan to do these things to the assertion that they were all acting on an implicit plan to do so. The government's case actually went from one based solely on a conspiracy of scary words to that of a thought crime. Essentially, that's exactly what happened. In fact, they began stating that the seditious conspiracy itself could very well have happened as late as when some of these defendants were on the steps of the Capitol, almost, you know, like via telepathic communication with one another somehow, some way. Never mind the fact that via their own evidence presented, the government's own evidence presented, when Rhodes and his operational leader on January 6th, Mr. Michael Green, who testified in this trial as well, began trying to gather the Oath Keepers, sending out messages through their communications channels, text messages, as well as signal chat groups, that as they were trying to send those messages to get the Oath Keepers to meet them, to gather on the northeast side of the Capitol, this was around 3 p.m. or a little 3.30 the 315, somewhere in there, that these messages that they were sending clearly said to come meet us if you're not still on mission. Not on mission? What was their mission? It was actually the seven different personal security details that the various Oath Keepers were engaged in that day. And this was before the whole security operation that they were on was shot to hell by the massive rioting that broke out and occurred before they even arrived on the Capitol grounds. But in Assistant U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Nessler's final rebuttal argument to the defense closing statements, he switched gears yet again. Despite the fact that during the entire trial, the government tried to diminish the veracity or the truth of these personal security details that the Oath Keepers were performing, they had been hit with the evidence. And when I say they, the government had been hit with the evidence of the actual permits. We saw them on the screens in the courtroom. The actual permits issued by the Capitol Police for the staging and where the VIP speakers that they were escorting would be set up on the Capitol lawn itself that day, that afternoon of January 6th, to which the Oath Keepers, as I said, were escorting their protectees from the Ellipse rally site to the Capitol for their additional events that day. There was also incontrovertible video evidence of these actual escorts taking place. We saw that in the courtroom. So instead of continuing to dismiss and belittle the idea that the Oath Keepers were on personal security details on the 5th and 6th, Assistant U.S. Attorney Nessler finally said that these security details were nothing more than just diversions. They were covers for their actual implied, not explicit, but implied intentions to attack Congress and hunt. I literally said that, to hunt Congress members. Now, I was sitting in the media room when he made this, you know, dramatic shift in front of the jury in his final rebuttal. And listening to those new assertions and distortions of the presented evidence just made my blood boil. As this would be the last thing that the jury members would hear before they began their deliberations. This was not a presentation of new evidence or facts, but this was just a final salvo, a brand new assertion that these five unarmed individuals, along with nine other indicted co-conspirators, were somehow going to overwhelm the Capitol Police, the D.C. Metro Police, elements of police agencies coming in from Virginia and Maryland as well, along with the tactical units that were engaged that day and on site from the FBI, the ATF, the U.S. Marshals, as well as the embedded Army Special Forces in the crowd. Against all of these forces, these 14 unarmed individuals were going to overthrow the government of the United States. That, folks, is the absurdity of what this jury is being asked to believe. Further, from the government's opening argument to their final closing on Monday, they told the jury that these Oath Keepers were the leaders of this attack on our democracy. Leaders. Leaders, despite the fact that not a single Oath Keeper was present at the initial barricade breach at 12:42 that afternoon. They were actually still at the Ellipse, sitting in the VIP section where President Trump was doing his speech. And they were sitting in this VIP section cleared by the Secret Service to be there. Allegedly, they were the leaders. And this was despite the fact that not a single Oath Keeper was engaged or even present in that initial battle line on the lower west terrace of the Capitol where law enforcement officers were being attacked and assaulted. They were leaders. This despite the fact that not a single Oath Keeper was present when those actual leading provocateurs broke that first West Side Senate wing window when they crawled through and then opened the door from the inside to the hundreds of protesters who then poured into the Capitol over the next 25 minutes before any Oath Keepers arrived at the Capitol building. These people were allegedly leaders, despite the irrefutable video evidence that not a single Oath Keeper pushed open the east side doors. They were pushed open from the inside by those who came in from the west. They were the leaders at doing all these things while they were outside on the east steps singing the national anthem when those east side doors were breached and opened from the inside. No Oath Keeper ever participated in the breach of a single outer barricade. Not a single Oath Keeper busted a window or so much as pushed open a doorway. But someone did. Someone actually led those assaults on law enforcement officers. Someone opened those west side doors. Someone among those on the west then either moved through the Capitol or moved around to the east side doors to assault law enforcement officers on that side before those on the inside pushed those doors open. But it was not the Oath Keepers. No film, no video to show that. Not only did the government never prove that the Oath Keepers had a conspiratorial connection to those actual leaders who breached barricades and opened doors and assaulted law enforcement, the government never even made an attempt to make a connection to those actual leaders. Basically, the government's theory is that the Oath Keepers knew this was all going to take place in advance and that they used the facade of providing security details for certain VIP speakers for other stages around the Capitol as a cover for their intended march toward the Capitol. And then, when the opportunity presented itself, they were to execute the interruption of the election certification. Not stated, not ordered, just implied. An implicit conspiracy to overthrow our government, unarmed by 14 individuals. It's just a maddening absurdity. As I've said before, if that truly was the plan, then this alleged conspiracy was executed by 14 of the stupidest individuals in all of world's history of warfare, civil war, insurrection, overthrowing governments. That our government can make this accusation against these 14 individuals requires a complete suspension of logic and common sense. But, as we know, half of this country seems to operate and make their judgments about all things that are political. And make no mistake, this is a political trial. But they make those judgments based upon their feelings and not upon the facts as presented. Unfortunately, this is a DC jury, where the jury pool, where they were chosen from, is over 90% owned, lock, stock, and barrel by the government itself. And when I say owned, I mean that literally. Literally every aspect of their lives, their jobs, their careers, their lifestyles are based upon the government's largesse in this community. What the government extracts from the rest of the country and then deposits in massive quantities here into D.C. as well as into the surrounding counties in Virginia and Maryland. These people are totally dependent upon government for everything. So how can we expect fairness and impartiality when the government itself is saying these things to them? That government which provides everything for them tells them their version of the truth, often in direct contradiction to what we saw with our own eyes in this trial. Finally, the most maddening moments in this trial for me came actually when Judge Maeda himself openly pretended that he had never heard of United States Capitol Police Officer Lieutenant Tariq Johnson, or he had never heard of the two Oath Keepers, including Mike Nichols, who together led a rescue of 16 Capitol Police officers out of the Capitol and then down those east side steps. Both Nichols and the filmmaker who captured that famous moment, which was broadcast and covered by mainstream media news sources all over the world, were actually sitting in the courtroom prepared to testify when Judge Maeda blocked their testimonies from happening. And this was, of course, done with the jury out of the courtroom, so they didn't see this happening. While the government with themselves was allowed to present many prejudicial videos of those outer barricade breaches, attacks on officers, provocateurs breaking through windows and doors before the Oath Keepers were even at the Capitol, Maeda then refused to allow the equal and opposite presentation of a video of actual Oath Keepers rescuing Capitol Police officers. The defense lawyers fought to get that testimony and video into evidence more than once, even bringing in additional evidence the next day that other of the alleged co-conspirators in this case, Oath Keepers not necessarily in this particular trial, were also engaged in the rescue. Maida angrily and forcefully argued that because they had no definitive relationship to these five defendants, that he wouldn't allow that evidence to be presented. But most telling was when Maida pretended that he had never seen that video. And then he took the time in court, outside of the jury's eyes, to privately watch that video on his own bench video screen, pretending to give the evidence a fair review before everyone knew that he was going to deny its admission into evidence. And then he denied it again. And then he denied it again. And the one thing that you're not going to hear from the mainstream media is that Oath Keeper Mike Nichols had actually already been subpoenaed by the government. I posted the actual subpoena signed by Assistant U.S. Attorney Nessler on my Locals page and also on Twitter. It was a preemptive ploy by the government because they knew that surely he would be an important witness for the defense if called. So they decided to get out in front of it as a rebuttal witness to show that, in fact, he wasn't necessarily involved with the defendants in his trial. But then the defense called him themselves, and then they, in collusion with Judge Maida, they struck down Nichols' opportunity to testify and sent him home back to New York after he had traveled all the way down here. They sent the filmmaker back home who flew in for testimony that day. And they sent them home before the jury could hear his story and see that compelling video of what Oath Keepers actually do, what their mission actually was, what it was always been, what it has always been over hundreds, even thousands of security details and disaster relief operations that they have performed since their inception 13 years ago. So, in closing, I just want to say a little bit about my interactions with the mainstream media journalists that I spent 8 weeks in the media room with. I'll soon write and talk more about this because I spent as much time observing them and their work as I did the trial itself. In short, very few of the 30-plus journalists that I shared the room with ever made any attempt to meet me, to interact with me, mostly not even to say hi in passing. I was the interloper, the outsider, was not part of their club, and as such, most of them treated me that way. Over the weeks, I did eventually have some pleasant interactions with some of those reporters. Alan Fuhrer of the New York Times, Carrie Johnson of NPR, Hannah Rabinovich of CNN, Brandi Buckman of Daily Kos, and even Ryan Riley of NBC News, just to name a few. Mostly, though, nothing from the rest. While I was impressed by the professionalism and especially the talent of many of these journalists, after reading their stories each day and each morning, I often wondered if they were even watching the same trial that I was seeing. We obviously just see the world through different lenses. My sole philosophical companion during the entire trial was a young lady by the name of Madalina Vasiliu. I'm trying to pronounce her Romanian name here. Madalina Vasiliu. Vasiliu. I'll go with that. Madalina Vasiliu of the Epoch Times. We stayed close and shared notes a lot. Madalina is a young 27-year-old writer for Epoch, and she covered the trial very fairly and factually with no editorial license, as you know I'm wont to do on occasion. She's a Romanian, as I said, and English is her third language. After her native Romanian, Italian is her second language, English is her third, and she's even now studying Mandarin. She's quite a bright young lady. She does great work, and I encourage you to follow her on Twitter and then all of, obviously, her stories at the Epoch Times. Okay, time for me now to head to Charlottesville for the rest of the week and spend Thanksgiving with my own kids. I'll be back at the district courthouse on Monday morning waiting for the jury's verdicts. As I said before, please, if you would, follow me on Locals. That's the best place. ThePragmaticConstitutionalist.locals.com. ThePragmaticConstitutionalist.locals.com or from your app store, download the Locals app and search for @TPC4USA. Obviously, I'll be tweeting out from the courtroom Monday, Tuesday, however much longer the jury deliberates. So you'll get it first from me if you're on Twitter. And then I'll, of course, jump over to Locals and report there next of what has happened and what verdicts come down when they do come down. Just as soon as I hear them, you will hear them. As I said, it's free to subscribe there on Locals, but you can, if you can, please become a supporting member for as little as $5 a month. If you can help with more, and you can, with any amount at all, you can make that donation there as well. In closing, God bless you all. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. I'm Steve Baker, Pragmatic Constitutionalist, and I'll talk to you again soon. Goodbye.